The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, I, Kennedy, Hugh Hewitt, inside the Beltway. The allergies are back. That means, as many of you have listened year in and year out throughout late April and early May in Virginia, my voice goes away some mornings because it's allergy season, and that's okay. I just will speak more slowly and in a lower range, and we'll get through it. I want to begin with a story this morning in the rundown that played a lot in the Beltway over the weekend, but I don't know that if it's made it into the national awareness. I would have led the Sunday shows with it, but of course they led the Sunday shows with Jake Sullivan, who was making the rounds yesterday, which is good. But the regime in Iran wants to kill Americans, and they have dispatched kill squads to the United States to do that. And we saw that with the indictment of people trying to kill John Bolton. I'm sure there's a long list of people who work for the former administration. And the Iranians are nuts, and you know that, and I know that. We should be doing a deal with them. But on Friday, after I went off the air, the U.S. Secret Service suspended four agents linked to two men accused of impersonating federal law enforcement officers who said, the authority said that these two men had given gifts worth thousands of dollars to the agency personnel, including one assigned to protect President Joe Biden's wife, Dr. Joe Biden. The two Washington Aryan men, Aryan Tahir Zadah, 40, and Hader Ali, 35, appeared in court on Thursday after being arrested. Prosecutors say they plan to charge them with conspiracy and a scheme in which they are accused of posing as U.S. Department of Homeland Security agents. Now, about this time of the morning in D.C., a lot of the great agents of the Bureau and the agency and the Secret Service and Homeland Security generally are headed to work. And thank you for all the work that you do, especially those security details that are keeping Americans safe as they go back and forth in the Iranians' crosshairs. But Team Joe Biden needs to step up. And I wish anyone would have asked Jake Sullivan. I went over the transcripts. I didn't see anyone say, so are the Iranians trying to kill Americans? And what are you doing about that? Because that would have been a good question. But of course, a legacy media is allied with Joe Biden, doesn't want to ask him about the Vienna deal, which is the stupidest deal ever done by America. It makes the first JCPOA look like give me a treaty that worked. I was going to say the Treaty of Ghent, but no one knows what it is. But it's the worst deal ever. And this one, new deal, makes the old deal look good. It's that bad. But I did hear one audio. I stopped the car, pulled over, and said they were coming up with a report on the Iranian men who were or the foreign nationals, they don't identify them as Iranian nationals, who were arrested, the two men who were arrested in the Secret Service who were suspended. I wanted you to hear that report from WTOP, cut number one.
10:17, and we're following new details about two men arrested this week accused of lying about being federal officers.
It was revealed at a hearing to determine if the two should be held until trial that 40-year-old Aryan Tirazadi was actually recognized in the past by D.C. police as a special police officer. That means he had some training and could carry a weapon. Prosecutors also said 35-year-old Hyder Ali holds a resident ID card in Pakistan and made two trips to Pakistan, one to Egypt, one to Iran, and one to Iraq in the past. Police seized numerous weapons and other police gear from the pair when they were arrested this week. They allegedly provided gifts to Secret Service agents, including the use of rent-free luxury penthouse apartments in Southeast. A decision on whether to hold the men until trial is expected on Monday. Kyle Cooper, WTOP News.
Okay, that's a short report. Did you hear that they'd made trips to Iran? You don't go to Iran unless the regime wants you to go to Iran. And the regime is... as we know, they're after Bolton. They're after other people as well. And I'm beginning the rundown this morning with a stark reminder to our friends in the Biden administration. And I say that broadly as an American citizen. Protect everybody. Protect them around the clock and do not deal with this regime. This regime killed an American. We ought to make it very clear that there will be nothing left of many, many residences in Iran. It's a long-standing tradition of the Iranians to assassinate people they don't like. on their, it's not like Soleimani at the airport about ready to kill Americans. They find an American at an airport ready to kill Iranians, fine. Take that individual out. That's a law of war. This is outrageous, and it doesn't get much attention because the national news media can't understand it, don't want to talk about it, and they definitely don't want to endanger the JCPOA 2.0. President Zelensky welcomed Boris Johnson to Kyiv for a surprise visit. It's one of the most inspiring videos I've seen on the internet in years. Just Boris and Zelensky wandering around Kyiv talking to people who are, there are not many people on the streets of Kyiv because they want to get hit with a missile. But it's like Churchill and his rompers, as they called them, off to the aircraft, anti-aircraft weapons in Hyde Park, where his daughter was stationed during the Blitz. Good for you, Boris. Ukraine and Russia are gearing up for the war's biggest battles, according to the Wall Street Journal. Ukraine and Russia poured reinforcements into eastern Ukraine this weekend, preparing for what likely will become the war's biggest battle as refugees continued to flee the looming Russian assault. There was a biggest tank battle in history was fought somewhere near here. A World War II historian can tweet at me where, you know, the tanks were everywhere. We might have that, but we might not. We might have man pads and missiles. Tanks may be seeing themselves go the way of battleships unless they're supported by infantry, Senator Cotton has said. Meanwhile, according also to the Wall Street Journal, thousands of educated Russians are quitting the country. The brain drain is extraordinary. They want out. They realize they are now international pariahs. They will be until Putin dies. They will be until the crazy man in the Kremlin stops warring on innocent people and firing missiles at train stations. Bucha is, according to the Telegraph, all of Bucha is a crime scene as investigators unearth one mutilated corpse after another. The scale of the job is enormous as 1,200 civilians have been killed in towns around Kyiv, with Ukraine accusing Russia of murdering many of them. Russian students, by the way, are being encouraged to turn on and turn in teachers who are insufficiently patriotic. So that's good. They brought the old East German Stasi tactics over to Russia. But Russia is used to a couple of decades of quasi-freedom. It's not really freedom. You can't go against the regime. It's sort of like the old Jim Kirkpatrick differences in dictatorships. There are three spheres, political, economic, and religious. And if you've got freedom in one of the three, you can't be totalitarian, even half freedom. So Putin allowed a great deal of freedom in religion, although he shut down the LDS. And in some economics, though, of course, he got shook down by the oligarchs. But in political freedom, none. But they didn't have an entire state-administrated sponsorship of turn in your neighbors. But that's on the rise now as Russian students tattletale on their teachers. Macron managed to make it through to the final two against Marine Le Pen in the French runoff. The result of Sunday's vote, according to the Financial Times, suggests that Le Pen is closer than ever to winning power for the right in France, emulating the nationalist victories of Donald Trump in 2016 and Brexit in the UK 6 years ago. I don't know, other than the fact that people just don't like Macron. All right. So that a poll of 1,500 people shows he's ahead 52-48. Within the margin of error. And that would be stunning if Le Pen, who began on the far right like her father and has moved more towards the middle, previously supported Putin, doesn't support Putin now. It would be a shock to the system if Le Pen wins. That might shock Germany into consciousness as well. Lockdown Shanghai residents demand food. They're running out of food in Shanghai. China's largest city, its most important city, is under extreme lockdown, and the people are upset. Israel's war between the wars with Iran expands across the Middle East, according to the Wall Street Journal. They've carried out more than 400 airstrikes in Syria in the last few years, since 2017. 400 times Israel has sent the Israeli Air Force to strike at Iranian targets in Syria, and that's the war between the wars. A Scottish minister compared women's rights, it's not women's rights, trans rights, anti-trans right activists to racists and anti-Semites. This minister, Susan Smith, is going to get tossed out of the government. President Trump endorsed Dr. Oz in the Pennsylvania Senate race. I think he is poorly advised. I have no dog in this fight. I just think Dave McCormick or Carla Hill Sands is going to win this. Carla Hill, the late Carla Hill, Carla Sands, former ambassador to Denmark. I think one of those two is going to win. They're both Trumpists, but he liked Dr. Oz from TV, I guess. And I just don't see Dr. Oz as seriously getting Republican votes. We will see. More stories ahead, America. That's the rundown for this morning, though. Secret Service, FBI, President Trump, State Department, get on your game and reveal to the American people how many Americans are the Iranians trying to kill? How many agents have we found? What's going on? I know it messes up your picture for a big deal that isn't a deal, but stop not telling us what's going on with this evil, evil regime. You're playing the punk here, Mr. President. You're playing the punk. Stay tuned. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, Inside the Beltway Live, joined by Selena Zito. It's time for the Yinzer Report. From Pittsburgh comes Selena. Good morning, Selena. How are you?
Good morning, sunshine. How are you?
Good. My voice sounds like your voice. So it's allergy season. Selena, yesterday or the day before, former President Trump endorsed Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania. It's a head scratcher to me. I talked to David McCormick last week. I'll talk to Carlos Sands this week. Dr. Oz, of course, welcome on the show if he'd like to come on. He declined to do most media interviews. I just don't think this is going to matter much in PA, but you tell me. You're the Yinzer.
Well, I have a story coming out today about it. It is incredibly perplexing to a lot of Trump supporters for him to support Dr. Oz. They see him as someone who had good instincts and good intuition, but are maybe concerned that Trump has spent a little bit too much time not on the road except to do these rallies and not in touch what's important to voters. And Dr. Oz has floundered since the first polling was done in January, where he was ahead. But he was the biggest name in the race. But after months of campaigning and ads and interaction with voters, he has just fallen, and David McCormick has risen up in the poll.
Well, Dr. Oz won't do media. Have you sat down with him?
I have.
How did that go? Does he actually know anything about politics?
Well, I'd ask people to read the story, but the thing that I thought would resonate with voters and in the end actually has. I asked him where his core beliefs came from. How did he come to his conclusions about his conservatism? And he said something about memorizing stuff. And to me, that said everything. To me, that said voters are going to see through that. They do not want someone who has memorized what core conservative values are. They want someone who has come to these conclusions through personal experience.
Now, there are three other candidates, each one of whom has been on the radio show, and each one of them impresses me in a different way. Most recently, Dave McCormick was on. I mean, he's a Bronze Star recipient and an 82nd Airborne guy in West Point. And he drips credentials, as do the other two. Dr. Oz, what was President Trump thinking?
I don't know. And if you look at the statement, it's really sort of telling. It says that he supported him because he was, it told him that he looked like he was in good health and that he was a celebrity on television. Then he lists his Harvard degree and New York Times bestselling books. Those are not things that matter to conservatives in Pennsylvania. Look, these voters are jacked up to turn out to vote in May, and even more so in November. And this decision by him has really, I would say it hasn't turned them away from Trump, but they're not. I couldn't find a voter who said that they were going to do this because Trump told them to, and or was going to vote for Oz. To begin with, voters tend to have three candidates that they're interested in, and it usually goes McCormick, Barnett, Sands. In that,
you mean Bartos? Bartos?
No.
Who's Barnett?
Kathy Barnett is a Montgomery County a political commentator. She's a black woman who's very charismatic and has a really sort of galvanized part of the base.
See, I didn't know about her at all, and that's just bad marketing on their point. I can't do every state. Bartos reached out. I had him on. Carla reached out. I had him on. Dave McCormick reached out. I had him on. McCormick is terrific. I mean, Carla
McCormick is
terrific.
Is leading. Yeah, McCormick is leading in the polls. He has done the things that I did a profile on him for the New York Post a week ago, having spent a couple weeks on the road with him. And he really does the things in the way that I have also seen J.D. Vance do. They're not the same kind of candidate. However, they're very good at getting out there and talking to voters where they are, going to these smaller and mid-sized towns and just walking into places and talking to voters and asking them if they can earn their vote.
J.D. Vance is coming up next hour as I do my second cycle through the Republican candidates. I've had on Matt Dolan, and I've had on Jane Timken. Mike Gibbon has been on twice, I think, and Josh Mandel twice. I think it's the second time for J.D. Who is winning in Ohio, Selena? That's across the border from you. You're not allowed in, but nevertheless, who's winning?
No, I just did a profile on the race for the New York Post. I think Vance is doing the right things to win over voters.
Oh, interesting. All right. Next week, Selena, I will read that. Go to the New York Post or go to SelenaZito.com for all things Selena. Sign up for a newsletter. You'll get every column. Don't go anywhere, America. Jake Sherman is next on The Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Good morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway with the man who knows Congress best, Jake Sherman. You can get his Punchbowl news delivered to you. He and Anna Palmer and their gang are always covering the Hill, even when they're not in session, which is this week. Good morning, Jake. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. I want to talk to you about three things that are not. I got my Punchbowl news at 6:04, so I'm totally read in on my Punchbowl news. But I want to talk to you about three things that are in it, because you don't cover it, but I want your reaction. First of all, I am mystified by President Trump's endorsement of Dr. Oz. McCormick is ahead in three polls. He's got the money. He's got the momentum. Why would the president do this?
Don't have any idea, to be honest with you. I've been told it was born out of Sean Hannity's liking of Dr. Oz. I think most people I speak to, including in the Senate leadership, believe that McCormick is going to win. Obviously, the Senate leadership has not weighed in on that race, but I've been told by pretty senior people in the Senate Republican leadership they think Oz or McCormick would win if they were the nominee. I think this will be an interesting test, though, Hugh, of Trump's endorsement in a state like Pennsylvania. I mean, a McCormick aligned super PAC, which we've featured pretty consistently in the newsletter, is just slamming Oz. And here's what I don't understand, Hugh, and you probably would agree with me on this. Oz has hundreds of thousands of hours, I would imagine, of television remarks. They are going to find the worst stuff that he has said, and they're just going to hammer him with it all of the primary campaign, and if he's in the general election, in the general election campaign too.
Yeah, Jake, I've been on the air for 31 years. People ask me, why don't I run for anything? And I tell them, A, I don't want to run for anything, but B, I would find myself running against myself after 31 years.
You know, right.
It's just, I don't want to do it. You know, the audio.
You've undoubtedly said things that you will have come to regret at some point in your life.
Oh, they would bring up the fact that I talked to Jake Sherman, a Beltway guy, every single week for 5 years, and therefore I'm a Beltway guy. I can't run for anything except in the district. So Chris Christie was on ABC yesterday. He said Trump's influence is waning. He pointed out the incumbent governors he's against who are going to win. Like Mike DeWine is going to win handily. It doesn't matter. And the RGA led by Doug Ducey, who's no friend of Trump, is out there funding a bunch of people. But Ted Budd is going to win in North Carolina. And Christie got that wrong. Chris is just wrong about that. Ted Budd has got quite the significant advance over Rory. So I don't think you can say Trump's influence is waning. It's just sometimes he spends it badly.
I will take a middle ground there and say that his influence is waning and he sometimes spends it badly. I think that if you look at a state like Georgia, it seems as if the incumbent governor is going to win. Brian Kemp seems to be doing pretty well. I mean, listen, we don't spend a ton of time on Trump in Punchbowl News. It's just not our area of expertise. But if you look at Mo Brooks in Alabama is falling behind. Trump pads his endorsement record by endorsing candidates that either are definitely going to win or do not even have a primary opponent. He did that in Texas. Many of the people he endorsed were going to win either way. So I think that I agree with you that some of these candidates are falling flat.
You know, I think Trump wins when he blesses but doesn't endorse, as he did in Yunkin land. And so if you hold back and then you bless someone as acceptable as a front runner, that is his max. Like if he had blessed Dave McCormick, it would be over today instead of looking at a black eye. Let me turn to something you do cover, Jake, because you cover the committees. I want to play you a WTOP story. It played all Friday and Saturday. I immediately saw it because I followed the John Bolton story, the Iranians trying to kill John Bolton. And I listened to this, and I can't believe no one is covering this, but maybe you guys will, because this is the Homeland Security and others need to be on this on the Hill. Cut number one, please.
10:17, and we're following new details about two men arrested this week accused of lying about being federal officers.
It was revealed at a hearing to determine if the two should be held until trial that 40-year-old Aryan Terrazadi was actually recognized in the past by D.C. police as a special police officer. That means he had some training and could carry a weapon. Prosecutors also said 35-year-old Haider Ali holds a resident ID card in Pakistan and made two trips to Pakistan, one to Egypt, one to Iran, and
one trip to Iran. You don't go to Iran unless the regime wants you there, and Pakistan, Jake Sherman. You know the story about John Bolton. They won't unseal the indictment of the people trying to kill him. Where is the funding for Secret Service to protect our people from the Iranian terrorists?
Well, very interesting you say that. There are, just as a side note, which is definitely related to this, there are a lot of people, former Trump administration officials, who still have security details because of the threat from the Iranian regime. People who were involved in national security policy under Donald Trump are still being protected courtesy of Congress, which makes these decisions. Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, Chuck Schumer, and Kevin McCarthy are part of a committee that makes those recommendations. This is a wild story. I don't know what to make of it. It certainly seems crazy. I mean, they had these ID printers, which if coded correctly, could let you into a place like the White House or other federal office buildings. So this is scary stuff. Literally in the middle of D.C., in the middle of I think Navy Yard, which is a popular place for young people not like me to live and to go out. So, yeah.
Oh, Jake, don't hurt me that way. When you say young people not like me, you're just like at two, Jake Sherman. But the point being, I don't know that the Congress is fully on top of this. I talked to one of the protectees this weekend as I was reporting on the story, and they get their extension like every month. They won't say, OK, you're good until the threat is over. I don't know what the Department of I know members of Congress who are deeply concerned about this. This happened with George H.W. Bush, and Saddam tried to kill him, and Bill Clinton just blew the hell out of some places in Iraq to send a message. I'm afraid the Vienna talks are paralyzing Team Biden from protecting our people targeted by Khamenei and his thugs.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious to see what else happened here. I don't have a good sense of what this is. But by the way, the policy on protectees is pretty constant. This isn't a this Congress or last Congress. This is just every single they reevaluate this constantly. And by the way, and I'm not saying they shouldn't do this, but this costs the federal government a lot of money to keep protecting people. And I think that they every single month, if it is every month, I don't know that it's every month, but every single whatever, they reassess the threat and they reassess how much security this person, a protectee, should get.
You know, Jay, I reject the idea it costs a lot of money. I know what it costs to protect people, and you could do everybody who served in the trip. You could do thousands of people as opposed to a score of people or 10, and you wouldn't notice. It's a rounding error of a rounding error of a rounding error.
Yes, it is a rounding error in terms of the federal budget, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, a rounding error of a rounding error. It's just not there. Let me go back to Leader McConnell This morning, John Ellis, who does a very different kind of newsletter than you do, it's the only other newsletter I get, he pointed out that Mitch McConnell is running on the platform that if you elect Republicans, Joe Biden will become a moderate again. I thought that was very witty. What do you think?
McConnell said as much on last Tuesday or Wednesday. He said he was asked if he would fill a Supreme Court seat in 2023 if it were to come open. And he said basically that Biden will be forced to moderate if McConnell is if McConnell's in the majority. Now, I don't know that that's true. I know that that's what McConnell was trying to say. It's a good bank shot for people who want Biden to moderate and want him to be a less liberal. I don't know that it's true, but it is what McConnell is saying, is that if they win the majority, Biden will have to moderate. And by the way, there is some truth to that. If you concede that the House is going Republican, which everybody believes that it will, and the Senate goes Republican, I think there's a pretty good chance that he'll have to moderate on some views, on some angles. I don't know that he'll become a complete moderate, but I think he'll have to on to some degree.
Now, I look down at Nevada, and I see Adam Laxalt surging and Cortez Masto fading away. Her offices are empty. She's falling behind in the polls. That state is switching, and the Latino vote there is becoming more Republican. I think she's on a most endangered list, but Colorado's Republicans in conventions bless the most extreme candidate. I don't think they'll win the primary in June. I think they'll get a fairly normal person. Washington State may be in play. Jake, is the map expanding for Republicans, Democrats, or is it balanced in its expansion?
I think it's expanding for Republicans. I think there's no doubt about that. I mean, I think I've said this to you before, but it shouldn't be any more complicated than this. In a good Republican year, Republicans should win races that are 50-50 races. And I know I'm not popular on the left for saying that, but I think that's the case. Now, each race is run on its own. I'm not passing judgment on any individual race. But if you look at a state like Pennsylvania, which should be something resembling a coin toss, if not maybe a little bit weighted toward Republicans, Republicans should win that race.
Period. Oh, God, please nominate John Fetterman. Please, God, nominate John Fetterman. Jake doesn't say that. Hugh Hewitt can say that. PunchbowlNews.com, rigorously down the middle and neutral. Go and subscribe to it. You'll be happy you did, as I am every day that I open up my PunchbowlNews.com. And I think Ellis Notes is good as well. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway. I am throaty this morning as the Virginia allergies legendary are back. I'm not sure what they're like in Ohio, but J.D. Vance may not have any voice at all because he's been out there on the hustings all weekend long. Candidate for the GOP nomination for Senate. The vote is in a few weeks. Good morning, J.D.
Hey, Hugh. How are you?
I've got laryngitis. How about you?
I think for different reasons, but yeah, my voice is stressed a little bit.
Yeah. Have you been up to the hot dog shop in Warren yet? You know, you can't win the Ohio Republican primary unless you go to the hot dog shop.
We've got to learn a list for the final few weeks. But no, I have not gone to the hot dog stand in Warren yet.
All right. Hot dog shoppy. It's spelled S-H-O-P-P-E. It's where Paul Ryan began his campaign for the vice presidency. I remind everyone that Jack Kennedy and John Kerry finished their campaigns at Trumbull County's courthouse in Warren downtown. So just a hint there, J.D. How goes the campaign? Tighter than a tick. I cannot tell who's ahead in a five-way race as Ohio closes to what, May 4th?
May 3rd, I believe.
May 3rd.
Yeah, so you know, we're 3 weeks out tomorrow is the way that I look at it. And it's definitely tight. I tend to think that, you know, Mandel and Gibbons and me are pretty tightly packed there at the top. And, you know, I think if the election were held tomorrow, I'd win. But unfortunately, the election is held in 3 weeks. So, you know, we'll have to try to maintain our position and get a little bit further ahead. But man, I feel good about it. Like, the energy is good. The debate's been very good for me. You know, people, I think, are responding to the message. That's all good.
Now, J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, obviously investment banker and Yale lawyer. When I did the first debate that got any attention, everyone was civil to everyone. Since that time, we had one candidate drop out. We're now down to five. Last I saw was a clip of Josh and Mike Gibbons sort of chest to chest, thinking to myself, oh my gosh, what's going on here? What has happened in these debates?
Well, I think a little bit is the stress of the final stretch, right? People start to turn their temperatures up a little bit. But you know, that situation, Hugh, what was so funny about it to me is, I was sitting next to Jane and to Josh Mandel, and you know, right before that whole thing happened, Josh was looking at a script. He was actually reading lines because I think there were TV cameras there shooting a commercial. And so the entire thing was actually prefabricated. It was a complete phony moment, which is why I think if you watch the whole thing unfold, it's very clear that he was trying to generate a reaction from Gibbons. Unfortunately, I think Gibbons fell for it a little bit. But I was embarrassed at the whole spectacle, but almost more embarrassed that you had it obviously pre-planned.
No, I've not endorsed anyone. I'm not going to endorse anyone, but neither is the president. Is the president going to endorse anybody, JD?
You know, it's a good question. I think that he will. I'm not sure that he will. He's coming to do a rally here, I think April 24th. And, you know, obviously that's in support of Max Miller, his endorsed Senate or endorsed Ohio rep, or excuse me, U.S. representative candidate there in northeastern Ohio. I think that he will endorse in the Senate race by then, but man, it's anyone's guess. And I think part of what the president is obviously optimizing for is he wants to endorse the person he thinks could beat Tim Ryan. He also wants to endorse a winner. And I think all these things matter. So we'll see what happens. I'm trying to earn it if the president's able to do it. But at the end of the day, if he doesn't give it out, then we've got to win the voters of Ohio regardless.
Now, JD, I think I mentioned when I moderated the debate, Tim Ryan's a friend of mine. We went to the same high school, though many years apart, actually. I'm 20 years older than Tim. Just like the golfer, Jay Kokrak, is another Warren Eagle. Well, yeah, we Warren Eagles stick together, but I'm not gonna vote for Tim Ryan. I'm not going to urge my family to vote for Tim Ryan. Who is best positioned to beat Tim Ryan? Now, you're going to say yourself, but tell us why.
Yeah, obviously, I think I am. I mean, I think there are a couple things, Hugh. First of all, Tim tries to position himself as this defender of working people. And first of all, when it comes to their jobs, when it comes to their wages, I think when it comes to protecting their paychecks by fighting inflation, Tim Ryan has been a terrible failure at that for the past 20 years. And Hugh, you know politics better than I do. It's one of the few professions where you can fail for 20 years and expect a promotion. Yes. That's exactly what Tim is trying to do. But the other thing is, even if you separate Tim's failure, I think to protect the people of his district on the economic stuff, you've got to protect people's values, right? You know this as well as anybody. You know, our people, we care about our Second Amendment rights. We care about having our kids learn proper American history and not being indoctrinated. Our people want to speak their mind at work without losing their job. I think Tim has been a terrible left-wing Democrat when it comes to fighting for people's values. And this is the mistake Democrats always make. They always make it all about the economics. The economics is important, but people are not just wage earners. They're also human beings with values and morals. You've got to fight for those things, too. And I think Tim's been a real failure there.
Now, as you've gone across Ohio used to be a toss-up state. It's deep red now, JD. It's a red state. Why do you think it shifted? Same thing is happening in Pennsylvania. Missouri was first. Ohio is second. Pennsylvania is third. They're going to become bastions of a new red wall. What happened?
Well, I mean, one thing happened is Donald Trump, right? So you had a lot of working class Democrats. I mean, I think people like my grandparents, right? They were FDR Democrats, Kennedy Democrats, but they became more Republican because they felt like Republicans were better at fighting for their wages and Republicans were better at respecting their values. That's happened a lot in these sort of, you know, manufacturing hotbeds all across America. You're right that Ohio is a little bit ahead of the curve, but I think, you know, Pennsylvania is next. I think Michigan, Wisconsin could be after that. If we could build a real, you know, red wall here in the industrial Midwest, I think so long as we send the right leaders to do it. That's one of the reasons why, you know, I'm running here. I'd like Ohio to stay red, but also to build a real coalition here in the Midwest that can win for the next generation.
JD, like me, you went east for your schooling and then west for your working. But I never went back. You went home, and in between, you also added the Marines, which I never did. And I think it's kind of interesting. East Coast elites, I say Beltway, Manhattan elites, but it's really East Coast elites, do not get the middle of the country at all, especially on education. And I wonder how much is education figuring into your conversation, because I've got another story here of indoctrination in California. And I mean, it's just indoctrination. And David Mamet's coming up next hour. People are sick of this. They do not want their kids indoctrinated at public school.
That's right. Yeah, they want them to learn, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic. I mean, to talk about something the elites often miss, we do these town halls all across the state. We're actually doing four today, I think.
Oh,
and, you know, one of the ones we did just recently, and we always take as many questions as we've got time for. And I was talking to an old pipe fitter who had just retired. And it's so funny, you know, I think the elites assume that this guy is not a smart guy because he's a pipe fitter. But if you know anything about pipe fitting, like the math, you know a fair amount of math to be a good pipe fitter. And this guy is complaining that he couldn't get good apprentices because the schools weren't teaching math. Now, of course, they're teaching critical race ideology and critical gender ideology. The guy may not be able to do arithmetic, but he can quote you, you know, Kimberly Crenshaw. That's what's happening in our schools these days. It's such a failure of just preparing people for the workforce. But of course, parents know it's also an assault on their values. So, yeah, it's figuring prominently in a lot of the conversations we're having. People are very worried about it. I think it's one of the reasons the Democrats are going to get shellacked in November.
Now, I agree with that. J.D., people have tried to paint you as pro-Putin. I know you. I know that's a lie. But I wanted to bring up the vote on last week. The House and Senate passed anti-Russia bill. And in the Senate, a revocation of their most favored nation status passed by 100-0. 100 is, I haven't seen that on a substantive issue since I first got here in 1983. Would you have voted for that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, look, I also think we need to be a little bit harder on the Chinese. You know, the reason people have come after me for being, you know, they accuse me of being pro-Putin is that I've tried to keep the focus on the broader set of problems we have in the world, but also here at home. You know, the thing I worry about with the way we're responding to Russia is it's actually drawing Russia and China closer together. And our policy has been really kind of dumb, actually. It's been all over the place. Where, you know, we're sanctioning some things, but not others. We're sanctioning energy, but of course the Europeans and people all over the world are still radically reliant on the Russian energy. You know, so America buys a little bit less oil. We don't make our own oil. So the price of the commodity goes through the roof. So Putin wins, the American people lose. You start to ask yourself, who's really meant to benefit from these policies? And so I think we have to just be a little bit smarter about how we go about this. You know, The number one thing I'm hearing from our farmers right now, Hugh, is that our fertilizer has gone through the roof. Well, we've done sanctions against Russian fertilizer, but the Russians have actually benefited, I think, from those sanctions because they're still selling it all across the world. The price has gone up. Now Ohio farmers can't do their thing, which, of course, is eventually going to mean that none of us can eat. These are the things that I worry about, is that we've just been not precise. We've been a little haphazard. And fortunately, you know, I use this phrase a lot. You go to war with the generals that you have, or of course, and shouldn't be in a hot war with Russia. But we are in a bit of an economic war, and the leaders of this war are Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. We've got to be much more careful about how much power we give these guys, given how failed our leadership here is in this country.
Now, I admit ignorance about whether or not we should be sanctioning fertilizer. I just want to cut Russia off. But what resonates with me is a lot of our elites are very anti-Russian. They're completely quiet on China and they're chasing Tehran. That's like going after Italy in the Axis, right? Okay, there's Japan and Germany over there and we're not paying that, but we'll be really harsh on Mussolini. No, the big dog is China and the second big dog is Iran. And Russia has nukes, but they may not work anymore given what we've seen. I just want to be anti all of the bad guys, JD. And I don't know that Wall Street has come around yet to being anti-China.
Oh, it certainly hasn't. But this is sort of the deeper problem here. I mean, you mentioned most favored nation status for Russia. I believe, doesn't China still have most favored nation status?
Yes. Oh, they should be thrown out. Absolutely.
Right. So this is the point that I made, is that Russia, I think, serves as a bit of a distraction where a lot of these guys can talk tough. They can appear tough on national TV. You know, Joe Biden gets to look presidential maybe for the first time in his 18 months. But behind the curtain, the policy is a horrible, horrible failure because we're not focusing on the things that we need to be focused on, which, like you said, that's China, right? That's a great analogy. I'm going to steal that, Hugh, where like we should be focused more on Germany than we are on Italy.
Well, if you go up to Warren, you should steal it because then people will be in favor. Are you going to finish in Warren at all, JD?
Well, we do a ton of these town halls. I mean, like I said, we're doing, you know, four today. We're doing them all across the state. We've been to Warren. We're certainly going to be back before the end of the election.
Good. That's just right. I just want to make sure Warren, you can skip Howland. Don't go to Howland. There's nobody there anyway. They only the dead vote in Howland. Good to talk to J.D. Vance. And we'll follow closely on the way in. Always a pleasure to talk to J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, candidate for the, you know, it's easy to be non-aligned in a race like this with five candidates. I talked to them all. That's the second time around for JD. I've had Josh on twice. I got to get Gibbons, Timken, and Matt Dolan back. Everyone's in double digits. It is the most interesting race in the United States. Of course, it's Ohio. Of course. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway. I'm using Jerusalem because it's my favorite recessional. That is the name of the brand new book by David Mamet, who joins me now live from Los Angeles. Good morning, David. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Thanks, Hugh. It's great to talk to you again.
You know, I'm so glad to learn you suck at small talk, because so do I. The last time I saw you was outside the Anarchist in L.A., and we had a rather strained, difficult conversation, because you suck at small talk, and so do I. Is that a disability you've had forever? Nixon could not make small talk to save his life either.
Wait a second. You're breaking out. Are you saying small talk?
Yeah, I think small talk, you know, chatter, the kind of flotsam and jetsam that a lot of people pass their conversation in.
Yeah, no, I you said a strained conversation. I remember a wonderful time chatting with you and your lovely wife. What, so did I miss something?
Yeah, I was ill at ease. I always am when I meet someone for the first time in person. So I'm glad you don't remember it that way. Now, the opposite. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, not at all. You know, me too. I don't like meeting new people, and I've already met all the old people. So I've kind of gotten through life by being a smartass and by saying things which are very embarrassing to my wife.
Ditto. So the opposite of small talk is to identify in a book the single most important sentence, which is hard to do, by the way. Now, I read all of Recessional in 4 days, as anyone who follows my Twitter feed will do. And here's the single most important sentence, David. I don't know if this is original to you, but I'm going to use it, and I hope the justices who listen to the show are listening right now. Quote from page 128. The Declaration of Independence stands in the same relation to the Constitution as does the Torah to the Talmud, period. Is that original to you?
No, it is original to me, yes.
That is it, my friend. That is it on the Declaration and the Constitution, and very few people get it.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you very much indeed, Hugh.
Would you expand on it for the audience what you mean by that?
Sure. The Torah means the law, and it's the Jewish Bible. It's all based on the five books of Moses, and then the commentaries after it. The major one of which is the Talmud, which is many, many volumes expanding what does this mean, what does that mean, how may we understand the law. But the law basically, the law comes down to the Torah, and the Torah comes down to the two tablets at Mount Sinai, where Moses comes down. He says, this is what God wants you to do. There's 10 things. You do these, we're going to be just fine. We don't care how you feel. We don't want you to do good. We don't want you to. You don't even have to help your fellow man. You do this, that'll be the biggest help you can do. Don't cheat. Don't steal. Don't have sex with your neighbor's wife. Don't carry the name of the Lord God in vain. 10 things. We're going to be fine. So that's the Declaration of Independence. It lists the abuses that King George perpetrated the American people, which are exactly the same abuses we see around us today and the government gone mad. There are too many taxes. There are too many regulations. Nobody's responsible. We don't understand who these new officers are who are forcing us to this event. He prohibits us from worship. He prohibits us from gathering. He prohibits us from free speech. That's what King George was doing. That's what the out-of-control government we see around us is doing today. So they came back and they said, okay, wait a second. Let's instead of kvetching about it, let's fix it. Here's how we're going to fix it. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. That's it.
That is it.
Yes.
That is it. And when I have Larry Arnon next and I read him this sentence, he's going to light up. I don't know if you've graced the Hillsdale campus yet, but for years we have tried to get people to understand that the center of the Constitution, as Lincoln said, the apple of gold is the Declaration of Independence and the silver frame is the Constitution. Now, the second most important thing in Recessional occurred a few pages earlier on page 88, where you say, quote, our Constitution is in essence a recipe in the form of a contract. You also use the example of a fake book and the example of a landing pattern. But you're right. It's a recipe. It doesn't just obviously present itself. You have to work through it. But the declaration is your North Star for doing that.
That's right. I say it's like my kid was trying to learn something early on, many, many years. My son, I got a bunch of kids, he's my son. And I said, well, let's talk about cooking. I said, what do you want to make? He said, I want to make macaroni. I said, okay, let's go make macaroni. Go into the kitchen. Look on the box. If you follow these five steps, you're going to end up with macaroni and cheese, right? If you try to interpret them or say that the recipe is a living document, Lord knows what you're going to end up with, right?
Yeah, it's not going to be macaroni and cheese. Yeah, or it's going to be really bad macaroni and cheese. But you wrote for an audience to understand constitutional law, and it's not that hard. People who try and make constitutional law hard just don't refuse to read. So, David, I want to contrast your simplicity and elegance in doing con law with this story from the New York Post on Saturday. Planned sex education lessons for first graders in New Jersey will include discussions of gender identity, instructions for teachers to tell students that their gender identity is up to them. Quote, you might feel like you're a boy, even if you have body parts that some people might tell you are girl parts. You might feel like you're a girl, even if you have body parts that some people might tell you are boy parts. And you might feel like you're a boy or a girl, but you're a little bit of both. No matter how you feel, you're perfectly normal. First graders, New York Post, not denied. What do you think, David Mamet?
Well, it's child abuse. There's no question about it. I have four kids, and I spent my life thinking about education and starting various schools and teaching various classes. Absolutely child abuse. And because a kid in kindergarten—listen, I did the Bill Maher show the other day, and I've known Bill for years, and he was wonderfully receptive and just couldn't have been more fun. And he's actually coming into the middle of the road. God bless him. But in the monologue, Bill started out and he started making fun of the don't say, quote, don't say gay. And all the audience cheering, yay, yay, yay. And I didn't say to Bill, nobody said don't say gay. This is a complete, it's a monstrous lie about child abuse. And so I think of it this way. What about if the government had these people who were in charge of teaching your children about child abuse, about sex? And they said, wait a second, you got a four-year-old, a kindergartner. We're going to come over to your house, and we're going to teach them about sex. You say, well, you know, I'd actually rather that you didn't do that. And they say, well, you know what? That's tough because we're the government, and you voted us in. We're in. We're going to teach your children about sex because you have created an institution which is in charge of delivering information to you, and we're going to deliver that information. And you say, well, wait a second, you're not teachers, you're the post office. They say, yes, but you can't deny the post office is in charge of delivering education, can you? No. At delivering information, that's what we do. We deliver information. Yes, but you can't deny that we're the government, can you? Yes, but you can't deny that you voted the government in. Yes, okay, so we're going to drop off your packages and your junk mail. Then we're going to take your four-year-old into the other room and tell her he tells him he may be a girl. They get the hell out of my house.
Well, your book, Recessional, is full of the pall of modern education. And I think you've diagnosed the pall that holds over America combined with the plague. And you wrote most of these essays during the plague years. So there it is. I could argue about you, about Bill Maher and whether he's good or bad. I think he's rotten, but we could argue about that a different time. Let's talk about Recessional. Is it possible, David Mamet, that when you were writing this, it was the worst time in America in my adult lifetime? The government was the most out of control. I think they have been so overzealous that what took the 70 years in Russia for the Bolsheviks to reveal themselves incompetent, horrible people and be overthrown might have taken the 17 months of COVID. I think actually there's going to be a revulsion, a vomiting out of Democrats everywhere as a result of the last 2 years. And so I'm something of an optimist. What do you think?
Well, I think that the Democrats are going to get blown out of office. I think they're absolutely going to get blown out. And there's two reasons. One is that the price of gas has doubled, right, which affects everybody. And you can't deny it. And the other reason is that mothers and fathers, the parents of children,
yes,
are saying, you can't have my kid. I'm sorry, you can't have my kid.
Yes. And that's why I'm kind of an optimist, even though you're right about the war on free speech, which is never ending. It is never ending, but we always win. And I like the new Supreme Court. I'm going to get to Donald Trump, but his greatest domestic achievement is his refashioning of the courts. And those three originalists that he put on the court, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, will do marvelous works with Roberts and Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito in the next in the very short order. And I think we will have turned the corner. Let me, however, turn to some other questions about recessional that I wrote. I've got the most heavily annotated. Do you annotate your books, David, when you read them?
No. But it's interesting you say that because, you know, one of the rabbis I was studying with, he was we were studying at his house, and he was actually writing in the Torah in the margin. I said, "Oh my God, isn't that blasphemy?" He says, "No. I do it to help me understand the Torah." But I never wrote in books because I love him too much.
You know, the world divides into those who do and those who don't. And I would not have put you down as one of those who don't. I learned annotation from Richard Nixon in 1978. It's the only way that I can do an author interview because otherwise I wouldn't have any help. I do have an outline of my outline, but let's go to that. My first non-important question, but it's important to me. Can you ever, you David Mamet, just watch a movie without simultaneously doing an autopsy? And here I'm referring to the years in between, you know, the 1946, where you refer to this is cheating by the writer. And I thought to myself, first of all, what does he mean by cheating of the writer? I reread it three times and I still don't quite get it. But then I thought to myself, do you ever allow yourself just to watch it? Can you turn off the inner writer voice?
That's a great question. No, that I watch movies all the time with my family, with my wife. We love watching movies. We watch basically old movies. And what we do is, because we're all smart alecks and writers, is we analyze them. The only time I don't analyze them is the movie is so damn good that I'm borne along and I just let it wash over me. That's very rare because there aren't that many great movies, just as there aren't that many great anything. But also what I do after watching a movie, I talk to my wife a lot about it. I say, wait a second, where'd they go wrong? Where was the scene where they went wrong? Why is the casting wrong? What would make that movie better? I've done that all my life, you know, being basically a stand-up comedian. I always hung out with other comedians. We say, I got to fix this joke. There's something wrong with this joke. Let's see if we can't fix it.
Well, what did you mean by this is cheating by the writer? That to me, I went back and forth. Well, I know there's a plot device here, but why is it cheating? Cheating is like the worst thing you can accuse someone of. It's not quite plagiarism, but it's cheating.
Yeah, it's Lenny Bruce did a routine once, the great Lenny Bruce, about a guy who's on stage. He's a singer and he's tanking. Everybody hates him. He says, "No, wait a second. This next song, people, it's not for me. It's for Jolie and Showbiz Heavy. Give it up for Al Jolson. This is a song for Al Jolson. Give it up for Al Jolson." So that's cheating.
Yes, right? That is cheating.
So I just watched this. There's a wonderful movie. How much? I don't want to overlay your time. Your time. Can I? You got?
We got plenty of time. We got buckets of time, David Mamet.
Oh, good. So I saw a movie. It's a wonderful movie. They made it in the 60s. They made it originally in 1934. It's called Imitation of Life. And it was from a novel by Fanny Hurst. And the story is there's a white woman who's broke. She's a single mom and she's broke. And this black woman comes to her door in 1928 and says, "Excuse me, ma'am, do you have any work? I'm here with my little girl. We have nothing to eat." So the white woman says, No. I don't have any money either. Here's car fare to get you across town. Please come in and have lunch." So the woman says, "Oh, okay." And while the white woman goes in the other room, the black woman makes some lunch, right? So the white woman comes in and she says, "My God, these are the best pancakes I ever had. And the black woman says, "They're a secret recipe that my great-grandmother passed down to me. And I'm going to tell you because you gave me Carter." So they become entrepreneurs. They first open a restaurant and then they sell the pancake batter worldwide. Right. It's basically it's the story of Coca-Cola.
Right.
Where the guy comes, he says, "Bottle it and make $1 trillion. So they become these entrepreneurs. The underlying story is they each have a young daughter. OK. And the white woman's young daughter is raised in the book. And they're co-equal, the two women invent this business. But the black daughter wants to pass for white. She says, "Wait a second, what are we doing here? I don't understand all these white people. We got as much money as they, but they treat me like filth and blah, blah, blah. I don't want to be black. I don't want to be black. And she keeps running away, and they have to keep bringing her. By the way, it's a genius performance by the two women. The older woman is played by Louise Beavers, who is, you won't see a better performance in the world.
Wow.
And the young woman is played by a woman named Freddie Washington, who was an African-American woman who... the people kept saying, you have white skin, you have green eyes, you're supposed to pass for white. She said, forget about it. I'm a black woman. I'm proud of it. And so that was her. She's a genius turn. So the movie is really about this. It's a love story between these two women who form this partnership and the horror of having children, right? And it's just a magnificent movie. Well, okay, halfway through the movie, they have to put in a love affair between Claudette Colbert and Warren William, right? They have this love affair, and Claudette Colbert is going to get married again, but she doesn't want to because that would upset her child, okay?
So it's a movie about upsetting your children that has to avoid upsetting a child. Is that cheating?
Well, no, it's not the cheating. The cheating is the love affair between the man and the woman, because like a lot of gay movies, they're cast in heterosexual terms. You already have a love story, right? The two women. You already have a problem. They have to get rich. You already have a greater problem. What happens to the children in a racist society? And how do these two women, a black woman and a white woman, deal with it together? That's the story. That's the story that we're following. You can't bring in another story two-thirds of the way through.
That's the cheat.
Please.
Yeah, that's the cheat. I get it. Okay. And the story that they bring in this other movie is that she finds a way to forgive him and marry him when she shouldn't have. And people have to read the book. I got to move on with my outline. David, I also tweeted out that the only works I have found helpful in writing drama, Aristotle's Poetics, Campbell's Hero in a Thousand Faces, Opie's Lore and Language of Schoolchildren, and be it what it may, The Use of Enchantment. Now, I'm not going to fill people in on Bedlam and all that stuff, but when someone like David Mamet writes that down, and I just had to take a picture of it and tweet it out to people, because would-be playwrights, I don't know if they read anything anymore, do they?
I don't know. See, in order to write to do a play, you got to do a lot of plays. That's the only way to learn, and you have to do them in front of an audience. Because as my father would say, other than that, it's purely suppository, right?
Your father, by the way, is my favorite line that's funny, is, are you nuts? When he found out the economics of a Broadway play. Had he never watched The Producers before?
No, it was before The Producers. Oh, can I tell that story?
Please. Okay, I love that story.
Okay, so I'm in New York now, and I'm back in the United States. The rest of the time I live in Southern California. So they're doing a play of mine called American Buffalo, and it's on Broadway. Wonderful guest, Lawrence Fishburne and Sam Rockwell and Darren Criss. But the play was originally done in New York, Lordy, maybe 35, 40 years ago on Broadway. And my dad and my family came in. And so after the opening, which was a huge success, as Robert Duvall starred in the play, it was a success poo, as we froggies say. It was just crazy success. We all go to Sardi's to read the papers. Because that time, though, I think there were seven papers in New York. We're reading the one paper comes in, it's a rave. Next paper comes in, it's a rave. Next paper comes in, it's a rave. Everybody's still glum. So my father says, well, these reviews are all rave. The plays are great. What are you concerned about? My father says, well, we're concerned about the New York Times. I say, well, my dad says, well, wait. One review in the New York Times can override all of these other reviews? The guy says, well, yes, the New York Times can close the show overnight. My dad said, what the show cost to put on? The guy says, $700,000. My dad says, what do you think the critic at the New York Times makes a year? The guy says, maybe 30 grand. My dad says, are you nuts?
It was so wonderful. And your dad, who is a great story, I don't know how he talked himself into Northwestern Law, but I annotated that as well. Jewish kid on the wrong side of Chicago with a single mom who goes off and fights the war and talks himself into Northwestern law and then goes on to proceed to represent the unions and the crafts and the trades. And he's obviously been around a lot of negotiations, and he does not understand that imbalance of power. And thank you for listening, America. I'm going to continue to talk to David Mamet about his brand new book, Recessional, The Death of Free Speech and the Cost of a Free Lunch. Recessional, available at Amazon.com. Go and get it. Come back tomorrow. The extended interview will be available at Highly Concentrated You, my podcast, later today. Make sure you download it. Highly Concentrated You. Get that every day at the same time. Highly Concentrated You with the interview added in. Don't go anywhere except stay right here. Talk to you tomorrow on the next You Do It show.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.